In every age, God raises people up to speak the truth to the world in a way that is currently relevant. Though our opinions should not be held with the same esteem as the biblical canon, we still carry the hope of Christ to the world. Our society has forgotten what it means to follow Christ. The bright lights of truth seekers are barely visible in the dim twilight of a post-Judeo-Christian society. We all see the darkness coming. All we can hope is to share the light that He has entrusted to us. This is Modern Apocrypha.
Hi, I'm Zeb Boykin, and I am glad to be on Modern Apocrypha.
Hey, you stole my thunder.
But
welcome, Zeb. Seriously. So, yeah, this is Modern Apocrypha. I'm Jared. This is Greg, and Zeb is our guest today.
No, glad to be here, man. Excited.
Cool. So, tell people a little bit about yourself. Give the audience some sort of short form history, something.
Yeah, I am Zeb Boykin. I recently started my YouTube back up, started a podcast called Touch Grass. Kind of a little bit of a unique idea. We video outside and I try to sit down with a variety of people, politicians, try to get into a little bit of theology, philosophy, outdoors, basically anything, and try to focus on a little bit of local politics and get a sense of where the finger of the nation is.
Makes sense. And so I know you have a background in the Marines. Any kind of history you'd like to share?
Yeah, so I did 5 years in the Marine Corps, did a little bit of traveling. In the Marine Corps, I did what was called Fast Company, and then I went to the infantry and did sniper school and did that for about 3 years and got out. Started a 9-to-5 job, insurance. Well, first of all, I managed an event ranch and then ended up in insurance and realized that I didn't want to work for anybody else. So I started my own business and I've been running two of them for the last 3 years. Got a little bit of time on my hands now because I've automated that and I've been studying various studies for the last, I don't know, 10 years because I've had to basically relearn everything that I've ever been taught. So here we are. Hopefully Jared can teach me a little something today.
Hey, man, we're looking to learn a little something from you. I mean, that sounds like relearning everything. So dare I ask, what do you mean by that? Where did you start?
I mean, everything. Man, So I did public school until 9th grade, and then I did private school from 9th, 10th, and 11th and 12th grade, so high school. Yep. I went to a college. I went a year and a half, ended up in the Marine Corps, got out, went back to college, and I was 3 credits short of graduating, and they wanted to do mandatory diversity training, and I was like, nah, I'm good, because I had already started the business by then, so I was like, I mean, I don't need a piece of paper, and so that's where I ended up. But when I say relearning everything, you know, I think what we're taught in school is extremely limited. We have this idea that teachers and credentials give people the authority and we put them on a platform where they know everything and they can teach everything. And that is simply not the case. So when I say relearn everything, I mean from the ground up.
Yeah. I know for me, it's really tempting, and I actually have to work not to get into sort of an opposite of that, because I've become so disillusioned with the sort of, what do you call it, the credentialism that is so rampant. It makes me want to go, well, if they have credentials, that probably means they don't know anything. And I sort of have to work against that now.
Yeah, there's definitely been a rise in gifting certificates, if we can, to people that are considered less privileged.
Sure.
So there's going to be an inherent bias towards non-credentials, at least in the coming future.
Well, and you know, even things like we talked about evolution a few weeks ago, how many college professors can you think of that you had any contact with who didn't swallow the whole evolution, you know, line, hook, line, and sinker? Because the deeper people get into this credentialed society where you have to believe a certain set of things to rise through the ranks, the more they get caught up in all of the sort of base lies that call it the programming that you had to relearn coming out of that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was going to the school for business, which luckily I didn't have to take too many sciences or humanitarian classes, but you know, I took a statistics class and a couple of base levels where the teachers were obviously so entrenched that they couldn't see the inconsistencies that they believed in.
Right.
And I don't know. It's like people have blinders on from past experience of, like I said, holding people to a higher standard than maybe they should be.
And even beyond that, when the sub-society that they're in requires them to have a certain set of beliefs to be socially acceptable there. Like in college, if you don't believe in evolution, you're not acceptable to everybody else. And so you don't really tend to rise. So you tend to self-select out of that environment. It's like, that's the reason I never went into journalism.
Yeah. So I went to a local community college to get my, a couple of associate's degrees, which was a blessing because, you know, the more local the college, typically the more similar the beliefs are going to be. And so I didn't run into that as much in community college as I did into the bachelor's. But even then, it was a relatively local college. So, you know, I didn't go 4 hours away to a state school. Which I think helped out a lot. But that's good. I did have some disagreements with professors. And I made my case for that. You know, I wasn't going along to get along. I mean, you know,
Have to go along to get along at some extent. I've seen even in our local schools where a silver-haired man goes back to college and provides every piece of documentation to prove his point. And the point doesn't go along with the cult of the teacher, and so he doesn't get an A+, he only gets a B+, because he didn't capitulate in his answer. He didn't tone it in a way that the teacher liked.
And I like that.
Something that is as cutthroat as the corporate world, where it's A+ versus A+, and if it's not A+, then you don't eat, then it really does become self-discriminating. I will say also, on the slippery slope of this, if you take only those certificated people to its ultimate end, you end up with a caste society where you can only succeed if your parents had the certificate, and you end up in these weird, not nepotistic, what do you call it, whenever people interbreed and fall apart because they aren't getting the genetic diversity they need in their small communities. Right, so these things play out over long periods of time, but they've played out over and over and over again. And basically getting a checkbox that gives you the right to speak or not basically is the death knell for your society.
I mean, I'm not entirely against what would be called legacy admissions. I would be against a non-merit admissions, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right. So if you have a legacy admission, you don't have a legacy admission. You have a legacy opportunity, right? You get to be looked at. But if Einstein's child is autistic and can't do math in any way, shape, or form, why should they teach math? There's nothing about your genetics that determines that because your father did something that you'll do something. There's nothing whatsoever.
I mean, there are exceptions, but typically IQ is genetic. So
You do have a tendency toward things that your family is good at. Like, my whole family have these mechanical inclinations. Like, the whole Michaud family has mechanical inclinations, and I got some of them enough to where I can work on my car and stuff, and it's not a big deal to me. But, you know, even though my inclination goes in other directions, I have abilities that do come through the family. So, I don't know. There are places where what you said falls down, Greg, but at the same time, there are places where the traditions and the things that we build our families on do tend to carry on to our kids. So military families often become military families through generations. People who,
but there's nothing that says that your military child will be the greatest military leader of all time. Likely, the greatest military leader of all time will come from a background so far removed from the military that it will blindside them.
Right. Well, and that's the tension there, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, I guess there's exceptions on both ends of that.
Yep. That's right. Which is why you can't close things off too much, right? You have to have the ability for people to move from one part of society into another, even if all of the levels of the society are relatively effective or not, you know, I'm not talking about moving from an underclass into an overclass. I'm talking about, like, what I'm trying to do. My family tends to be mechanical. I'm moving into a more literary, more media sort of focused life is my intent. There has to be room for that, right?
You want to maintain the culture and the tradition while still allowing for an absolute merit base. Is that what you're kind of getting at?
Sorry, I disconnected for a second there.
You're looking for a tradition and a culture to be maintained while allowing for a merit based.
Yeah.
Baseline.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's exactly
disagree.
Right.
I'm looking for pure merit base. I'm expecting that my children will be high succeeding, high performers in that merit base because I was born and raised in it. And so they were born and raised in it. And so they've got advantages in it, but they still have to perform. Nothing about me gives them the advantage other than my positive influences.
Right. Well, we all agree on that, Greg. The point that he's making is just that those tendencies that we do have, like with my family, you know, this whole mechanical thing tending to carry on, that there's nothing wrong with that, but that there has to be a merit base in how we do things. We kind of got totally off on a weird tangent here. Any final word on this, Zeb, before we move on to other things?
I think even this, something like this is built into our governmental system. You know, why does the Supreme Court not have term limits, right? It's to preserve tradition and culture.
Yeah, and there's value in it. So we wanted to get into a little bit about, we're recording this about a week before it's going to go live. And this is the day when the conviction came down for Trump in New York. I got to ask, you've listened to a number of our podcasts. I know you have. So you have any thoughts on this? Anything that you think might be different from what Greg or I might have to?
I think the understanding of the Trump trial is universal on both sides. It's just that we come to different conclusions because we both have bias. Trump is the singular most political, divisive person, right? There's complete polar opposites with respect to Trump. And I don't think a conviction or an acquittal is going to sway any voter, just as I don't think a VP pick is going to sway any voter either, right? So it's for show, I believe. And they'll file for appeal, and I don't think they'll get an appeal because the appeal court is bad too.
Let me throw this out there. Further than just saying it was for show, this is a show that's being put on by powers and principalities to create a dialectic to manipulate the American people. Any disagreement there? Anything you'd want to speak to there?
We all dove into the dialectic, what, last episode? I guess two episodes ago now.
Yeah.
So I'm extremely heavy into the idea of principalities and the spiritual world interacting with our physical world, and that the principalities are far more intelligent than we are. And I don't think we can comprehend how intelligent they are to a point. So, yeah, I mean, I would absolutely believe you on that. I'm not entirely convinced on the dialectic, as a purity, but I mean, there's obviously something there.
Well, it's just a tool to manipulate people. People, when there are two sides to an argument, people feel like they have to jump on one or the other. That's the whole point of the dialectic.
While it was going on, I watched live streamers looking at it, and the Trump donation sites were getting bombarded so hard with new donations that they were going down. Right, so that set up a board so that there's two sides fighting. Whether or not either side is good is not in the question.
Well, I think the dialectic is inevitable. And what really gets me is in Europe, they don't really have a dialectic in the way of political parties. I mean, there's obviously a split left-right. They have a much more diverse of choice, and I don't understand how it's not a dual-party system. Because inevitably, you have to vote to win.
I have a thought on that, if you're interested.
Let's go.
I think that has to do with the fact that America is the power center of the world. It's the imperial power center of the world. And so because of that, the power games are focused here. When you move out of the top power slots in America, whether it's local and state politics or Europe or whatever, you end up with a little bit more diversity of viewpoint, even if you don't have the, like, example, you still have Democrat and Republican there where you are. I know you do. But at the same time, you can't always pin people to one party as easily on a state level, or especially a local level, as you can on the national level, because people are just different. And I think that kind of speaks to what you're saying. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I guess that makes a little bit of sense, but not enough to where, like, Europe has 20-something parties to choose from, right?
Well, Green Labor. There's also something to take into account with this, that in the same way that, like, a Ross Perot might ruin a Bush run, right, where a third party kind of throws a kink in the works in our system, that's planned over there, and the most powerful party couldn't win if there were two parties. They don't get 50% of the vote. So in order for them to maintain power, they've got to keep throwing. So where you've got a lot of power, a lot of control, they just make a new government, say the old government doesn't matter anymore, and put them out to pasture.
I think maybe you're missing my point here. My point is that the powers and principalities seem to care a lot about who has power in our society. And that when you wind up with a power center focused in your nation, that tends to attract their attention, and they create a dialectic to pull attention in the direction they want it to go in, where in other areas where they are not as focused, they don't try to create that as much. So you do have a lot more optionality in where people wind up.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, you know, that they put a lot of effort into creating this singular split, to where you have to choose a side, or you know, choose a side of the fence, or you're going to fall off of it, you know, pick a side of the road, or you're going to get run over.
Right.
I understand where you're coming from, but I think that's an inevitability with or without them, just based on the idea of democracy and voting.
But you someone just in. Gave the counterpoint, dude.
But I think it's inevitability, though, because people vote to win, typically. They, you know, people want to be on the winning team. And over time, it creates this power structure of
I either have certainly to vote this one win, or this there'll one. There'll be times whenever they want to win a political party. There'll be times they want to win abortion rights. There'll be times they want to win for Christ, right? What are you winning? Who are you fighting for? And that will affect the stratification quite often. If you've got a fairly large portion of the populace that believes that fighting against slavery and fighting against, you know, women's rights, taking out and increasing men's suicide rates to, whenever you got something to fight for that is more important than money, then you'll see it break apart into groups that find those things that are important. It's when we boil things down to everything is a dollar, everything is a watt, everything is the same unit of measurement, that's when it comes to
that. I think you're expecting
we can't possibly agree to be of the same group unless we do that.
I think you're expecting too much of voters with that. I mean, people vote with their pocket, one, and two, people like to win. And if they vote for a candidate that loses, they simply feel bad. So they vote for a candidate that wins. You know, it's the idea of the lesser of two evils at the end of the day.
So how does this play into what you had brought up about Europe? Because their political systems are, if anything, older than ours. And yet ours has come to what you consider to be sort of a natural end state.
I don't understand. That's what I'm saying.
and what I'm doing is I'm offering you an explanation, because I think that it's only a natural end state when you really focus the power in that location.
I mean, I'm not denying that. I'm not saying it's not possible.
I'm just proposing it. I don't know.
It's natural with or without the principalities. I think it's human nature to want to win. I think it's human nature to.
Fair enough.
Not lose. You know what I mean? So, and if that not lose means vote for a lesser of two evils, then yes, maybe I don't completely grasp the European democracy system.
Maybe let me just ask another question to sort of refocus this a little on Trump, because I think we've kind of played out this discussion point. Would I be right to say that my opinion on the effect of this verdict is basically that the only effect it's going to have, if anything, is to activate people for Trump, that's the only real possible effect it's going to have? Other than that, it isn't really going to have any particular.
Both sides. It's just a separation. Both sides will grapple to their side, whether it's a Trump side or a non-Trump side. They'll go to their side stronger.
Sure, but in the anti-Trump side, what that consists of is, oh good, he got convicted, now we get to gloat. Where on the Trump side, it has created real antipathy, real anger against the system, and that is actually going to make people get moving. So I think in the end, no?
I don't know. I don't think so. Like I said, when I kind of, you know, in the initial question, I think the people that are going to vote for Trump are going to vote for Trump. The people that aren't going to vote for Trump aren't going to vote for Trump. And the people that are going to vote for a Democrat is going to vote for a Democrat. And the people that aren't. I think it's already set in stone. At least who's going to vote who. Now, when the numbers come out and those are manipulated, however they're manipulated, that's a different question.
Well, and I guess what I'm getting at is this, that
I don't think it moves the needle either way, basically.
What percentage of the population normally votes? You know, it's like 10% of the population that's eligible to vote that actually votes most of the time. And so maybe a little more than that, but you get the point that there is only a certain percent that normally votes. And that what I'm getting at here is that the people who are pro Trump are going to be galvanized by this to the point where they're going to be agitating really hard for what they consider to be justice over the next 6 months, which could push things in some direction. I don't know what direction, but it's made them mad.
I guess the question would be, in what way? I mean, are we going to have MAGA BLM riots? Like, you know, I mean, we're not going to have protests to the point of
Well, that's the national question, news. Isn't it? I mean, well, that's the question. Yeah. We don't know exactly what form it's going to take, but I'll bet you.
We have hundreds of millions of dollars of donations to the political ads.
That's all you'll get.
We'll also likely have large numbers of Democrats thrown in jail / prosecuted and found guilty.
Not going to happen, man. It's not going to happen. It's simply not going to happen. They own court system. Look at it. They own the court system. You appeal to the Manhattan court. It gets thrown out because they're not going to take it because it's.
Well, we recently had Mr. Butker come out as a professional athlete speaking for godly things, and it didn't really turn out easy for him. But he's not the only one. He's not the only professional player. But
we may have athletes, but we don't have the judicial system.
But you just don't hear about them.
Yeah, okay, we may have athletics, but we don't have the judicial system.
We don't have the judicial system in New York. We certainly don't have the judicial system in Michigan. But I promise you this, in Tennessee, that's a bit of a different question. In Wyoming, that is definitely a different question. There are other states in the country, and this is one of the interesting things about the U.S., because we're divided up into states, it isn't just one playing field that we're playing on when it comes to the courts.
Yeah, I mean, I can agree with that, but, you know, how much goes on in Montana? How much goes on in Idaho, right?
That's
everything's,
the question,
everything's concentrated in California, New York, D.C., Maryland, Pennsylvania.
Well, and
you might get a little bit of leeway in Florida, but.
You know, you may be right here. And this is actually why I asked, because the answer the question that you basically just returned to my question was, what else could happen other than just big donations? And the answer is, I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, I interviewed Stephen Horn, which did a very deep dive into January 6th, and he's got a documentary, 79 mm-hmm. Minutes, Breach to the Capitol.
Okay.
It was very in-depth, and kind of talked to him about it. And his take on, you know, another January 6th is it's not going to happen, at least not in the same vein.
I agree.
Basically,
with that.
He said we have to build similar tactics to what, you know, Antifa has built, right? We have to build a protesting tactic where we have to cover our face, because at the end of the day, they're going to arrest you. I mean, they're, you know, arresting 1,200 people that were on January 6th, right? The DOJ is weaponized against the American patriot.
The federal one is, for sure, no question.
Yeah, and even almost all state is too, but, you know, that's a different question. And, you know, I don't know. I hate to say it like this, but I just don't know if we have revolution in us as a group, because I don't know what the group is. And I think that's a primary issue, is who is we? Like, who is us?
We are the vocal. I will tell you this just to uplift you. It is a positive thing. I've heard everyone say it from Sam Harris to Jordan Peterson. There's not a space where everyone doesn't agree that, whether you call it a woke mind virus or some principality has pushed so far that every truth seeker of every vein, every small businessman, every self-thinker has been pushed together against the powers and principalities. Everybody has been pushed out of their comfortable places.
Has been pushed onto one side of the dialectic, not against the powers and principalities. That's the key. Hey, we're coming up on a break, so is there any... I'm going to let Zeb have the final word here before we go to break.
No, I mean, I could keep diving, man, but you know, at the end of the day, I think we have to acknowledge what is the issue, who is the enemy, and who are we. Before we do any of that, nothing's going to happen.
Fair enough. And I'm just interested to see where it goes. I don't know.
Oh, it's definitely interesting.
Yeah, you got that right. All right, everybody. Well, we'll be back in a minute.
Back in a minute, everyone.
Bright Star has been out for over a month now. I just want to say thank you to everybody who has helped to make it the success that it already is. I've got a huge, huge plans for the future. Great things going on, working on the audiobook, working on the anthology, working on book two. Everything's moving along. Just thank you, everyone. If you don't have a copy yet, you should grab one. Head over to e6universe.com. Use the promo code Israel for 10% off.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people enjoying Modern Apocrypha. As many of you have seen, I'm an avid coffee drinker, and I've been drinking North Arrow Coffee for a couple of pounds now. You can find North Arrow Coffee at northarrowcoffee.co, all one word, where they list coffee of the month and how green coffee is handled. I've been enjoying some of the number 4 Honduras and some of the number 10 Peru, available at northarrow.co. If you'd like to help support us even more, you can use discount code E6 for 10% off your copy order today. Thank you.
And we're back.
Welcome back, everyone.
So, we talked a little bit about Trump. We went down a few rabbit holes, and the main thing that I wanted to dive into with Zeb, he was telling me that he considers himself a Pelagian, and I don't know exactly what that means or what you would mean by that if you say it. So, can you sort of tell us what?
Yeah. What that is? Well, you kind of threw that one on me a little bit, but you know, I've kind of dove a little bit deeper into it recently. Mm-hmm. But the basic premise is, you know, the idea of original sin, and Pelagius was, you know, kind of a contrarian to Augustine, where mm-hmm. Pelagius was more free will, more Arminian, and the sense that, you know, we weren't born with sin, we weren't born with guilt, and that everybody could come through, choose Christ freely to become saved. And then, you know, on the other hand, you have Augustine that, taken to his logical conclusion, which Calvin did, is that everything is predestined and we are all mortally damned unless chosen directly by God. And so that's kind of the basis for who is Pelagius. You know, he was a British monk that kind of came from that census, but you know, there's something called Molinism, which William Lane Craig advocates for, or a semi-Pelagian position, which I think I identify more with, but
okay,
kind of the baseline there.
Okay, I suppose that makes some sense. I know, so I suppose I've said this before, but I have never studied into what any particular person in history believed about any particular thing myself. I have more read the Bible and looked to see what it says and listened to the Holy Spirit. And that's pretty much how I constructed my worldview. I didn't actually go through any particular tradition. So when you talk about stuff like this, Zeb, it's stuff that I'm actually not familiar with. It's stuff that I don't know. So I wasn't trying to dump anything you. I just didn't actually understand what you were.
Pelagian holds a view that is extremely Arminian.
Okay.
When taken to its logical conclusion.
I don't know. You know, I have a hard time explaining where I even come down on this, because effectively, I agree with most of that.
Which position that you're not born with sin?
That with a more extremely Arminian position in a lot of ways, I think that the sin one is pretty indisputable, because it's directly in scripture that it is a part of us, but exactly what sin is or how it works is something that
most
people don't.
So let's say it's human nature to sin, right? You know, Paul says
a newborn with no experience would have sin.
I would assume, so that's the argument, right?
But if you look at scripture, it says that 12,000 Jews will be saved and taken to the promised land. They were newborns with no sin on their lips. They were blameless. How could a baby be blameless if all babies are blameless?
Greg, you need to read your epistles a little more in order to get a clearer idea of this particular point, because Paul actually comes out and says that, I think it's Paul, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Zeb, Paul comes out and says that as all sinned in Adam, so Christ, the new Adam, the second Adam, allows us all to get free of that in some sense.
So
that's
that would
a terrible
be
paraphrase.
Terrible paraphrasing, but a paraphrasing that would state that post Christ, babies are okay.
No.
Hold on.
Okay.
I'm just read. Or so the basic premise is Romans 5. We'll just do NIV to make it easy.
Yeah.
The basic premise is Romans 5, 12 through 21. And I'll just read that real quick so we can kind of have a grasp of where we're at. And so this is Paul in Romans 12 through 21. He says, therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man and death through sin, and in this way death came to all people because all sinned. To be sure, sin was of the world before the law was given, but sin is not changed against anyone's account when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking the command, as did Adam, who is pattern of one to come. But the gift is not like the trespass, for if man died by the trespass of one man, how much more did God's grace and the gift that came by the grace of one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to the many? Nor can the gift of God be compared to the result of one man's sin. The judgment flowed one man's sin and brought condemnation, but the gift followed many trespasses and brought justification. For if by the trespass of one man death reigned through that one man, which more will those who receive God's abundance provision of grace and the gift of righteousness reign through the life of one man, Jesus Christ. Well, that's through 17. But the basic premise is grace granted to the point of salvation even if Christ isn't accepted, I guess, is kind of the position there.
And the answer is we don't really know.
Well, I would say that Paul argued more toward Pelagius than he did Augustine when he says, so we say Romans 5:12, just as sin entered the world through one man and death through sin, in this way death spread to all men because all has sinned. Right. All men have fallen short of the glory of God. Right. It's a human nature to sin. And there's only one exception to that, which also had a God nature.
That was Christ.
Yes. So Paul says, just as sin entered the world through one man, so sin entered the world through Adam, and death through sin, in this way death spread to all men. He doesn't say sin spread to all men, right? We're all destined to die, but we're not all born with guilt or sin.
Well, and I think the question of that involves the question of the law, right? Because that's why he brings that in, is that unless people know the law, then they don't know that they've sinned. And if they don't know they've sinned, then that can't be held against them. That doesn't mean that the action that they've taken isn't sinful under the law. It just means they didn't know it, so it can't be held to their account. So It's a slippery question in one sense. And then the other thing that doubly complicates this is a lot of times Paul takes a view of things that almost tries to use God's perspective. Like he almost tries to look at things from a outside of time predestination sort of viewpoint. And that's really hard for us as humans to internalize. And that's why Peter in 2 Peter basically said, he cautioned people. He said, you know, Paul in his wisdom said things that were really hard to understand and have led a lot of people to destruction. Well, it's because they try to take this to a, in a way that is not appropriate, and it's because it is hard to understand. So understanding what Paul meant exactly and where he was coming from when he was talking about this stuff can be really difficult. With, like you're saying, with an Arminian perspective, with one that is more focused on a free will side of things, you can understand it a little more clearly, right? It's a little easier to understand, because that's sort of the way I think of that, is almost like sitting in a natural human skin, looking around going, yeah, my choices matter. I'm making choices. They have effects. That matters. That's important. By the same token, God is outside of time. So reconciling those two things is difficult.
Yeah. You mentioned agency and understanding that there has to be an application of that, right? So we don't hold people accountable that don't have agency. And neither does God, I don't believe, right? So this is why, you know, I don't believe in paedobaptism, right? We don't need to baptize because, well, first of all, baptism doesn't save. And second of all, there is no sin to wash away.
Well, and baptism was, the way it was given to us sort of descriptively is as an act that people took once they repented, at once they converted, it was sort of a physical acknowledgement of that. That's sort of the description we get of it. And so putting that on a baby is like you're trying to predestine your child to Christ, and it doesn't work that way. That's a position a lot of
you know, Roman Catholics and Orthodox take is in the way of paedobaptism. But, you know, they also believe heavily in predestination and the chosen, or the called, rather.
Right. And from God's perspective, this is actually something we ought to do a whole episode on at some point, is the whole free will versus predestination thing and what that actually means from God's perspective. Because from the perspective of a God who sits outside of time, is it possible to say that the human creations who are subject to time were not chosen, were not called? Is that even possible to say? But so, from the perspective of humans who sit inside of time, who actually do have meaningful choices, is it possible to say that I don't have a meaningful choice?
Yeah, so that's a very good question and a deep discussion. It would definitely take a full podcast. Again, I'll reference William Lane Craig and his Molinism. I believe I have Time and Eternity back here. But he wrote a book, Time and Eternity, also. And he kind of posits that God essentially placed himself inside of time. And, you know, he kind of has to wrestle with a few things inside of that. One, which I believe, is if God is ever outside of time, he is always outside of time, right? You can't erase what is outside of time. But then he posits there's three knowledges, and the middle knowledge is what they hold to in Molinism, which is God can see what would be chosen on an individual level throughout all of time in the most complex position. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
He can see what would be, and therefore he knows what is.
Well, okay, so let me give you a touch of background on this. And I don't know, I don't want this to come across as arrogant, because that's not the way I feel about it. It's more a case of, I'm going to give two examples here. When I was a kid, the story of Job drove me crazy. And when I finally surrendered that to God and said, okay, so I trust that you were right in what you did, and I'd left it to him, he came back 2 weeks later and inspired me with the understanding I needed to get it and to see why what happened to Job was right and how he, a good God, could have done what he did there. I don't know that I can put it into words properly, but I got that. And when we talk about this outside of time thing, when we talk about what God's perspective is on it, I have gotten a touch of, like, a peek into that here and there. And all I can say is that when you're asking the question of free will versus predestination, it's you're kind of asking the wrong question, because we obviously have free choice. We have choices that matter. That's a natural part of being human, and it's one of the first things we learn as infants, is that our choices actually have impacts. And how God accomplished that is kind of amazing. I mean, that really is the miracle. But to say that we understand how predestination and free will and God all interact is kind of silly, because we can't sit outside of time. And if we could, it would be obvious.
You're basically saying that's an unknowable.
I'm saying that from our perspective, it's unknowable. That when I have asked for the perspective required to see it, I have gotten glimpses, and it just reinforces to me that it's a stupid question the way we pose it most of the time.
I mean, there's obviously consequences to our actions. And I'm not saying that we have complete free will, because I don't know if we do have complete free will, because that's...
Well, what would that mean? At that point, you get into a question of definitions. It's like, does complete free will require that no one ever have a knowledge of what we do before we do it? Obviously, that's not true. God knows what we're doing before we're going to do it. He can foresee that. So it's a question of definitions at that point, right?
Right. A couple of passages strike me. God empowered the Pharaoh to use his free will in persecuting the Egyptians before the Israelites
before their
expulsion from Egypt. But that was still the use of God, or God's usage of free will, right? It wasn't free will taken. And separately, Jesus healed the man who was on the mat and who he said specifically was put here for me to perform this miracle, not that he did anything wrong. So there's two different things described, both an expression of free will that is a part of God's plan, and also some figures in a specific place and time outside of free will. Right? It seems like both are described.
I mean, you could look at like a story of, you know, Paul on the way to Damascus, right? So where we got a donkey talking. Obviously, there's some intervention there to kind of nudge Paul in the right direction. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely intervention.
Sure. And
it goes both ways on principalities, too. You know, you kind of mentioned Job. We've talked about principalities on the first part of the episode, that they, you know, they have a direct impact on how the world goes around.
Well, they do, obviously. And as you said, they're way smarter than we are, probably to a level we can't comprehend. And they have power that we don't understand. But by the same token, God is, you know, orders of magnitude yet above that. And he sees what's going to happen before it's going to happen. So trying to, from a human perspective, put God's actions in a particular box and say, this is how God works, is asking for trouble. It doesn't serve us. And it tends to get us into trouble when we try to do it.
It's kind of like an observable universe question. You can say what you see, but you'll never see it all.
I don't know. Any thoughts here, Zeb? I know I kind of ran away with
no,
that.
No, I mean, we can kind of get back to a little bit of the issues on, you know, Pelagius. The question would be, if you're born with original sin, would Jesus not be also born with original sin? Right? And so because it would then be genetic. And I think the Roman Catholics hold a position of Mary is also sinless to try to get around this, because they hold the Augustine, you know, Calvinist view that we are born with original sin. And so they have to kind of jump through a few hoops to get to the point that Jesus is not born with original sin, which Mary, you know, the whole position of Mary is sinless, which is, I don't even.
There's no scriptural backing for that, certainly.
Yeah, and there's no big scriptural backing, but I mean, even without the scriptural backing, it's like, how do you hold that position? I mean, she would then be God herself, which would be, right, you know, understandable as well, how they venerate her sometimes.
And the whole scripture saying that, what is it that none should boast? It's the rest of it's escaping me. I memorized this.
What do you guys feel about the Ezekiel 18, the son shall not bear the sins of the father?
Ephesians 2:9, is what you're looking for?
Yeah. It's by grace through faith and not by works, so that none can boast. The idea is that if anyone measured up to Christ, then they could boast, and we don't. And so to me, that's sort of the core of this question, is and let me get to what you were asking in a second, Greg, but just going into what you brought up there, Zeb, you know, the way I have been thinking of sin lately is sort of almost as a disease that the human race contracted through Adam and through what happened there, and that Jesus Christ, because he is God, was able to defeat that. He was able to be sinless, and he basically, because that gave him a legal right to pass his justification over us, to hold that over us as an umbrella, so long as we declare allegiance to and have faith in him, we are then given that covering. But he also has the freedom to bestow it on whoever he chooses. It's his, he owns it, he can give it to whoever he wants, whether they're 2 weeks old or, you know, yeah, not born yet, or
so that's,
whether they,
that,
yeah,
that position is a little bit Calvinistic in the idea of a disease, because in essence it's passed down through genetics.
I wouldn't say it could be passed down through culture without any genetic need.
Well, and what is, how do genetics and epigenetics and whatever interact? And what I'm getting at, though, the core of what I'm getting at, Zeb, is it is scriptural. It is in scripture that sin came to us through Adam, and that it's through Jesus that we are
right,
cleansed of
sin. Right. Sin entered the world through Adam. We can go back to Romans 5:12.
Right.
It said, just as sin entered the world through one man, which will be Adam. Right. So it's not that sin didn't exist. It's that it entered the world through Adam, because Adam sinned. Right. He didn't go to Eve. He went to Adam, because Adam sinned.
Right.
He said, and death through sin. So death did not exist prior to sin. Right. This is a chronological thing. Mm-hmm. And so death is brought to humans through sin. And in this way, death spread to all men. Right. Because all is sinned.
OK, so define sin. And that's the difficult part.
Or any objection to God, right? Because God is the standard of morality.
Any falling short of the standard of God.
Yes.
And
in the idea of morality, yes.
Well, but is it just in the idea of morality? Can you specifically say that? Because
you can have like Levitical sin, which is like a sin of ritual.
Right, exactly. And what I'm getting at here is just that when we, in my mind, sin is defined as just falling short of the glory of God, falling short of the perfection to which we were designed originally. And do I think that was part of me when I was born? Yeah, I do. I do think that was part of me when I was born. Do I think that it would necessarily be held against me by account when I wasn't aware of it?
Yeah,
no,
you,
I don't.
You hold falling short of God as an action. yet there is no action prior to birth. And then there is no agency prior to understanding.
Right, but I'm saying it isn't an action, it's a state. Falling short of God is a state. We are not. Right, our state falls short of God's state.
Which is why we die.
Right.
But it's not why we're not born in sin. We're not born with guilt. If that makes
sense. Okay, guilt is a different thing from sin. And this is why I say it's all down to definitions. Because the way I understand the Bible to talk about sin, sin is not, it isn't just about the guilt. It isn't just about a wrong action. It's about a state of being that is less than what it should be. And whether it's genetically or personality-wise or hormonally or whatever, those things, that lesser than what it should be, is a part of us when we're born. So to say that we're sinless, it depends on how you define sin. Is my baby who isn't born yet, has that baby committed sin? No, I don't think so. But is that baby born in a state that is falling short of what God created it to be originally? Yeah, I think so.
Well, is a baby conceived into a state that has fallen, that isn't living up to?
Yeah, I think so. Because the physical, our physical genetic makeup is corrupted, and it is not what it was created to be.
Right. So you have to hold it to a genetic issue.
Right. Well, whether it's genetic or just the fact, you know, in Genesis it says the cursed is the ground because of you. Whether that's the whole world or whether that was the second law of thermodynamics changed, or, you know, exactly what happened there, we don't know. But the point is that sin entered the world through Adam, and we're all born into a sinful world, and that affects us. So to say that we can reach a state of perfection or something is silliness, in my opinion, because the state of things is damaged.
Then the question is, does Jesus not have a human nature? Because if the human nature is born into sin, then you're granted the issue of Jesus Christ was born with sin, unless he didn't have a human nature. And then you have another issue.
He was born fully God and fully man, which means that whatever fallenness there is in the world was not...
See, you have a consistency issue. You have to grant the idea, unless you want to make Mary sinless somehow. You have to grant.
Okay, so we know that Jesus did not commit sin, right?
Correct. Yeah, but you're saying it's not possible for human to be sinless. Out of inherent sin, inherent born into human nature. I'm positing that it is possible, but it'll never happen because we are human and we have human nature.
Well, I actually, when you put it in that way, I agree with you. What I'm saying here at base is that we have a problem with a definition of sin that we don't fully understand. And my intent here was just to sort of bring that to light, that we don't really understand what sin means. And so
I'm not arguing with you. I'm just saying.
And so when we say that he was born without sin and that he never sinned, we can say that that's true, but we don't really grasp the core of what sin is, because we think of sin purely as being a trespass against the law, when really the law is descriptive of, and it helps us to see. It's like a glass we can look through to see the sin that is there, but we don't really understand exactly what sin is except through that glass of the law, right?
So you don't hold sin to be essentially a willing transgression. Or you're saying that you don't know. I know you're saying that, but...
I'm saying that... That I'm not... That I can't grasp at exactly what sin is and describe it clearly. And you know, that's a problem for me.
When Paul says... He basically says, that I want to do, I cannot do, and that I don't want to do, I do. Right. So he has an understanding that there's a willful act that has to come along with what he holds as sin. Now if it's knowingly sinful, is a different question.
That's a poor understanding, because you can take a 2-year-old that lashes out and smacks their sister, and that's a sin. Right? It's not thought out. It is an action, but it's not a thought action. It's a thoughtless action.
Right, but the two-year-old doesn't have agency. It doesn't have understanding to the point of...
Yeah, you spank that 2-year-old a couple of times, they got agency.
I mean, positive and negative reinforcement works on monkeys, but we don't hold them to account either.
Right, but there is a point, and if you think back to when you were a little kid, I'm sure you'll sort of catch it. There is a point where you get that instruction from your parents or from whoever, and you then disobey that, and that agency comes on you, and you know that you did, and you did it anyway. I remember it, man. I distinctly remember that feeling.
We're all rebels.
Sure. And I guess saying that Christ never participated in that is accurate.
Well, I mean, you would have to have a God nature to offset the human nature of the inevitability of sin.
Okay. Does that make sense? I agree. Yeah, and I agree. And I think that's fair. And to be clear, what I have been saying up until now, I wasn't actually trying to argue for something. I was just describing the problems that I'm seeing and trying to understand.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, we've all sinned. We've all fallen short of the glory of God. There's only one way to Christ, or one way through heaven. That's Christ, and God's grace. So,
and there's the gospel for you in a few words. And to anybody who's listening who doesn't know Christ, ask him. Say, are you really there? Give me some hint. Show me. If you mean it, you want to know, he'll show you. May not be when you want him to, may not be the way you'd want him to, but he'll show you.
Yeah.
If you're open to it, he'll.
Well, there's a little work on your part. You know, you have to seek out the truth. So I think
I'm into that.
Any search out for truth and you should end up where you should be, as long as there's no blinders and it's an unbiased adventure.
If you seek the truth, then you shall surely find it. Cool. Thanks, Zeb. It's been fun, man. It's been a good discussion. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. I might hog the screen a little bit, but
no. That's the whole point. The whole point is to have you on to do that. Thank you. And as always, everybody, I guess we'll catch you next time, unless there's anything else, Greg.
Nope. Thanks everybody for stopping by. Be safe. It's going to be some wild political times coming up.
Oh, yeah. Sure. It's election season. Yeah, and thank you for having me on. I actually enjoyed it. So.
Great to meet you, Zeb. It's been really nice.
It has. Before we go, tell people where they can get a hold of you if you want to, or if not, that's fine.
Yeah, all my handles are basically Zeb Boykin, YouTube, Rumble, Twitter, kind of the main way. Then I'm probably start doing Facebook and Instagram a bit more here coming up, so.
I'll drop a couple of your links in the show notes. You can send me a couple of places people can get a hold of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
We'll catch you next time, everybody.